couple of Sundays, we've been working our way through a series of characters in the book of Acts, talking about how they exhibit fearlessness in what they're doing. And I have two left that I'm getting ready for this week in Pennsylvania that I'm leaving on Wednesday for. And so I had the option of doing either Aquila and Priscilla, which I've been assigned, and I have no idea what I'm going to do with them, or Paul, which is a sermon that just writes itself. So I got to my office yesterday because I was just going to do the Bible class, and someone else had volunteered to come preach for us. And then he texted me and said he had COVID. And so looking at no sermon ready, when I got to my office yesterday and needing to come up with something before today, I said, I think I'll just go with the one that writes itself. And I still have no idea what I'm going to do with Aquila and Priscilla, but they'll find out in Pennsylvania, and if it's no good, you guys never have to hear it. So that works out well for everybody, right? And if it's okay, then maybe I'll bring it back and do it here, too, just to kind of wrap things up. So we are going to be talking about Paul today.
Unlike the dilemma with Priscilla and Aquila, there is just an overabundance of wealth when you consider the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts and see his fearlessness exhibited in just a variety of ways. And, I mean, we could think about a variety of contexts of persecution. I'll run through a list here in a second. I've got a quick list of 22 different things that I came up with from the book of Acts and outside the book of Acts, but it relates to the time that Acts is talking about. And so I want to run through that here to start with, because there's just so much to consider when you think about this. And then it kind of becomes a problem of how do you narrow it down in terms of what to talk about. So beginning even before you get into the missionary journeys and the persecution, one of the things that Paul has to do is decide that he's going to step away from being a rising star of Pharisaic Judaism and turn his back on all of that and everything that he has known. His parents were Pharisees. He was raised by being taught by Gamaliel, who was the preeminent Pharisee and rabbi of the day. And he is turning his back on that, probably a path toward a seat on the Sanhedrin Council himself, and saying, I'm giving it all up. And there is a fearlessness in making that decision that I don't know that we frequently reflect on enough in terms of what Paul was giving up in order to come to Christ from that very worldly sort of perspective. And then the next thing that he has to do is go show his face in the very churches filled with the people whose friends and family he'd been persecuting and killing. Which that would not have been an easy thing either. It's not like he's giving up one cushy life for another cushy life. And it's not just that he's giving up this great life to go be persecuted, but he's giving it up to be persecuted and have to go look in the eyes of the people that he was persecuting. And the difficulty that would come with that at the beginning. And then as a Jew, taking the gospel into a Gentile world, with all of the difficulties that come with that, both in terms of his own upbringing and getting over that, but also beyond that, the hostility that he's going to face from his brethren for what he is doing and the difficulties of just traveling. I mean, we think it's hard sometimes if, you know, we're going from here to California. Oh, what a terrible trip it's going to be. Yeah, terrible. Imagine what Paul was going through. Just the difficulties of traveling constantly through his life and taking the gospel to the Gentile world. And then as the missionary journeys begin, as we call them, he goes to Pisidian Antioch in Acts chapter 13, where he is persecuted and driven out of town. He goes to Iconium in Acts chapter 14, where there is an attempt made to stone him there in Iconium. He goes from there to Lystra in the same chapter, where they succeed in stoning him, and they leave him for dead. In Acts chapter 15, they're back in Jerusalem as they're discussing the journey that had happened. They are characterized in verses 25 and 26 as having risked their lives for the name of Jesus. As we talked about in the class, in Philippi in Acts 16, they're beaten and imprisoned. In Acts chapter 17, others are persecuted because of Paul. You don't really find out about Paul himself being persecuted a lot there in Thessalonica. The text doesn't record it. Maybe it happens, maybe it doesn't. But others are persecuted. And that probably was harder on Paul than Paul being persecuted was. This is the sort of thing that anyone who's a parent knows. As your children get sick, particularly when they're young and helpless and can't understand what's going on, you think, I would love to be sick instead of them. I'd be thrilled to take that away from them so they don't have to endure this thing that is going on. How do you think Paul felt about other people being persecuted because he was preaching the gospel? That was probably harder for him than his own persecution was. In Acts 18, things seem to go generally well in Corinth while he is there. But it's Corinth, and you know that's not the end of the story. And so whatever persecution or difficulties or not happened when he was there the first time, from there until the last time that he is in Corinth, there is just a wealth of difficulty that is faced there because of the Corinthian congregation. On the third missionary journey, he goes to Ephesus, and he'll spend some 3 years there in the city of Ephesus, a place where in 1 Corinthians 15, he characterizes his time there as having fought with beasts in Ephesus, which is probably metaphorical rather than literal, although I don't know that that's an impossibility. Whatever the case is, it's not a pleasant time when he is in Ephesus. That's where he writes both of the Corinthian letters that we have in the Bible. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, he says, "We do not want you to be unaware, brothers, of the affliction we experienced in Asia." And Asia is the province that Ephesus is the capital city of, where he spends 3 years. "We don't want you to be unaware of the affliction we experienced in Asia, for we were so utterly burdened beyond our strength that we despaired of life itself." And all of this, the whole Corinthian correspondence and difficulties is happening in the midst of all of that. There in Ephesus, there's the riot that happens that's talked about in the book of Acts, where you have what amounts to a 2-hour chant against monotheism in a stadium that is filled with some 25,000 people. And this is one of those things that I don't know that we can really grasp how terrifying that would have been. I mean, this auditorium isn't that full today. But if all of you got up together because of something that I said and stormed the podium, it would be terrifying to me. If I upset you that much that all of you together rose up against me, that's an intimidating thing. If I was over at the college and I was giving a lecture in February and I was in Hutchinson there and there were some, 400 people there, 350, whatever the number would be for a lecture there, and all of them stood up in one accord against me, that would be even more terrifying. Or if I was at the gym for a night lecture and there's like 1,500 people in there, and think of how scary that would be. Well, this is more than 10 times that number of people all gathered together, chanting together against what Paul is doing. And Paul wants to go out there and face them. And they're like, "No, Paul, you're not going out there." They have to hold him back. It's an incredibly frightening moment there in Ephesus on top of everything else. And this, again, is by the way, where Paul writes the Corinthian letters. So this is where I want to take a second and step aside from the story in Acts and jump over to 2 Corinthians 11. Because this is where Paul is categorizing the difficulties in his life up to this point. Now, of course, what Paul is doing here is he's presenting an ironic resume. He's saying, there are these other people claiming to be apostles and claiming to be teaching a better gospel than I am, and they're touting all their great credentials and how wonderful they are. Well, let me tell you how wonderful I am too. I've been beaten and rejected and forgotten and everything else. So it's this ironic resume, because this is what a disciple of a crucified Christ ought to look like, is sort of the point. And so he's not just listing his persecutions for the sake of listing his persecutions, which is kind of what I thought was going on as a kid. He's presenting the case for him being the apostle of the crucified Lord. And in that context, it makes very good sense what he's doing and why he's doing it. But notice, he even says, "I'm talking like a madman. You forced me into doing this. I'm just being a complete fool in this." But there in verse 23, "Far greater labors, far more imprisonments, countless beatings, often near death. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews, 40 lashes less 1. Let me just stop here. I won't say this all the way through, but notice, Acts doesn't talk about that. And so we're reminded here at the outset that everything that we've seen in Acts up to this point is not the full story. And also we know that 2 Corinthians 11 doesn't talk about everything either, because it doesn't record everything that we read about in the book of Acts. And this is only up to the, you know, third missionary journey, not everything that happens after that. And so everything from this point on in Acts and beyond the book of Acts isn't talked about either. So this is just a very partial list of what's going on in Paul's life. So 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews 40 lashes less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. 9 I was adrift at sea on frequent journeys, in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, and toil and hardship through many a sleepless night, and hunger and thirst, often without food, and cold and exposure. And apart from the other things, there is a daily pressure on me and my anxiety for all the churches. That last verse, when I was much younger, that was kind of a throwaway verse for me. All this terrible stuff that happened. Oh, by the way, yeah, I also worry about the churches. I really think that it probably is flipped. That the concern for the churches weighed on him a whole lot more than the physical abuse did. Especially as he's writing to the Corinthians. And the concern for this church that has weighed on him in so many different ways. Well, just to continue on, because we're only on number 14 of 22, before we run out of time, as this is ending, he goes back to Miletus to meet with the Ephesian elders, and he's talking about things weighing on him. He warns them about an impending heresy that is going to happen there, false teachers rising from among them. And whether that's from the Ephesian Christians or from the Ephesian elders, I don't know that we can say precisely, but something bad is coming there in Ephesus very soon. From there, he returns back to Jerusalem, where he is arrested for something that he didn't do. 2 during his imprisonment in Jerusalem and Caesarea after that, in Acts 23 and in Acts 25, attempts are made on his life. In Acts 24 and 25, he becomes a political pawn in the hands of the Roman governors there, who basically jerk him around and drag out his imprisonment rather than dealing with it and giving him a fair verdict one way or the other, which compels him ultimately to have to appeal to Caesar. That's his only hope of being freed, he believes, but also that brings with it the possibility of dying. So he gets on a boat and heads for Rome, where he is shipwrecked and snake-bitten along the way. The book of Acts ends as he is there in house arrest in Rome, but it seems that he is probably released at the end of that imprisonment. In Philippians 1, he anticipates being released. In Philemon, he anticipates being released. And in 2 Timothy, it's very clear that he doesn't think he's going to be released. So either things have changed drastically from one pair of letters to the other, or what I think is more likely, and what the early Christian writers outside the Bible say as well, is that Paul was in fact released from that Roman imprisonment at the end of the book of Acts. He will go on preaching more after that for a few years, where there's all sorts of persecution I'm sure that we know nothing about, before he is rearrested under Nero and the Neronian persecution that the church experiences there in the mid-late first century, where he will be executed, which is exactly what he expects there at the end of 2 Timothy. And again, there's a whole lot of silence between those accounts. The 2 Corinthians passage makes it clear that Acts doesn't record everything. And the fact that the 2 Corinthians 11 passage shows up at number 14 out of 22 on my list makes it clear that it's also missing a whole lot of what Paul endures as well. The fact that Acts ends before Paul's story ends also tells us there's a lot that we just don't know. So in terms of trying to narrow it down to what are we going to talk about when it comes to Paul's being fearless, what I want to turn to is something I've talked about here before, but I think it's worth talking about again. And maybe in a different sort of context than I've talked about it before, and that is, how is it that Paul has this attitude? how does Paul get to the place where he endures all the things that he endured? Because I don't know about you, but I look at this list of things, and I look at the events of Paul's life, and I see a superhuman that does something I could never possibly do. And again, I don't think that's the point of the biblical accounts, is for us to look at the people in the Bible and say, well, they're doing things I can't possibly do. I think what we do is we look at them and say, how do they do this so that I can do it too? And this is where I think we find something of the answer to this in something Paul will say in 2 Corinthians. But before that, I want to turn to Philippians chapter 1 and see what this is going to look like in Paul's life as well. And I'm going to contrast it with an example that shows you the exact opposite perspective. So Philippians chapter 1, we'll spend a few minutes here in this letter. Now, Philippians is a letter Paul is writing from his imprisonment. I take this to be his Roman imprisonment. I think that the first Roman imprisonment, I think that's by far the best understanding of this. He is going to be facing Caesar soon. He is going to either live or die as a result of the trial. We'll see here in just a moment. And I think the best solution for that is this first Roman imprisonment at the end of the book of Acts. That's significant because that means as Paul is beginning this letter and beginning to talk about his imprisonment, that means he is imprisoned for something that he never did and he should have been released for years before this. He's arrested on trumped up charges of having brought a Gentile into the temple, which he didn't do. And then for the next few years, Felix and Festus play political games, and he never gets released, which forces him to have to make this appeal to Caesar, which is why he is in this place writing this letter. Now, I don't know about you, but I could see myself being pretty bitter about all of that. And I could find myself looking at this saying, Lord, look at all of the things that I did in your service. I mean, not to make myself special or anything, but by your hand and by your power, I traveled the Greco-Roman world, teaching the gospel and establishing churches. And what have I done for the last 3 years but sit and rot away in a prison? Why haven't you done something? Dear Philippians, you remember when I was arrested there in Philippi a few years back and God sent that earthquake that set me free? I've got a great idea. Let's get all our prayer warriors together and start praying for an earthquake. And get me out of this prison and back to preaching the gospel. It's not about my freedom. It's not about my comfort. I want to get back out there where I can preach the gospel and be persecuted again, you know? And so it has nothing to do with me and my desires. I could very easily see myself thinking that sort of thing and even rationalizing it in that kind of way. Especially given the context of how awful everything has been up to this point. And so in Philippians chapter 1, Paul says in verse 12, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me, that's all of this, what has happened to me, what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. So that it has become known through the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Paul says, I've been imprisoned unjustly, and my trial has been dragged out as long as possible. And here I am in Rome, now sitting around waiting for Nero to get to me. And what has happened has been just great. Because I've got an audience that I wouldn't have gotten before. I got to preach to the imperial guard. I got to preach to Nero's own elite group of soldiers. And on top of that, the Roman Christians, they've been emboldened by my imprisonment. And they're out there preaching the gospel even more. This has just worked out great, is the way this has worked out. He goes on to say in verse 15, some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. So there are people out there that are preaching the gospel with the wrong motive. Paul says that the brethren here are emboldened to preach because of my imprisonment. And they're out there preaching. And of all those people that are out there preaching, some are doing it for the right reasons, and some are doing it for the wrong reasons. Some are out of their love for me and their love for the gospel are preaching Jesus to the world. And there are others that are out there and what they're doing is saying, Paul, I'm as good as that guy is. I'll show him. And you know what? As I preach the gospel and I tell them it's the same gospel Paul preaches, that'll just make things worse for Paul. I don't know exactly what they have in mind, but their preaching is designed to hurt Paul. Now, can you imagine anything that would frustrate Paul more than someone preaching the gospel with the wrong motivation, selfish ambition as a motive to preach the gospel, designed to hurt Paul in the preaching? It's hard for me to fathom a long list of things that you would expect would upset Paul more than that. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. Yes, and I will rejoice. Paul says, whatever. They're doing their thing. They're doing it the wrong way. And Paul very well may say, I have problems with that, and I'd love to talk to them and straighten them out. They need to get their act together, but that's not his point here. His point here is, whatever they're doing, however they're doing it, people are talking about Jesus. That's good enough for me. That's the sort of thing I think we should probably reflect on a little bit more at various times of the year when society is more apt to hear the gospel. And we're inclined to sit here and say, well, we shouldn't be talking about Jesus right now because this reason why we're talking about Jesus has nothing to do with Jesus. And we get all high and mighty and say, you know, lay down the law of when and why and how. Maybe we should say, Christ is proclaimed and in that I rejoice. Because that's what Paul says here about something that's far worse than, you know, what calendar day Jesus might have happened to have been born on or not. So Paul says, I will rejoice. And he goes on to say after this that I am going to be facing Caesar. I'm going to this trial. And it's going to end one way or another, he says. I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance, as it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not at all be ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I'm hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. What Paul says is, I'm going to find the answer to my trial. And it's either going to be life or it's going to be death. And either way, Christ will be glorified. And either way, good things will happen. He says, this is what I think is going to happen. This is what I'm confident is going to happen. I'm sure I'm going to be released. But at the same time, he doesn't know for certain. And so he says, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I depart, I get to be with Jesus. If I stay, I get to be with you. And so here, what Paul says is, there's a question that is yet to be answered. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. But either way, it'll be just fine. So he looks at what has happened and the bad things that have happened. And he says, this has been great because I've got to preach. This has been great because the gospel is being preached. And this thing that I don't know, either way, it's going to be just fine at the end. So what Paul does is he looks at these situations in his life and he says, everything is just fine as it is. And again, these are things that I can't begin to fathom how he takes that perspective if I'm just looking at it from a worldly point of view. You've been falsely imprisoned. Your trial has been dragged out forever. People are preaching with awful motives to make your life worse and you might go die. That's a terrible list of things for Paul to say, it's good, and it's good either way. It's an incredible sort of response that Paul has. Now, on the far other extreme, you've got a different group of people, a group of people who are living away from their homeland. They're living in a place where things had been good for them for a while because a relative had been in a high position. But he dies and time goes on and a new king comes to the land and he doesn't care about that guy anymore. You know, of course, I'm talking about the Israelites there in the book of Exodus. And as the book of Exodus begins, I'm going to read through a series of passages really quickly. I don't expect you to follow along. I'll tell you where they are if you want to try or to jot them down to look at them later. Beginning in Exodus chapter 1 and verses 8 through 11. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens." And the story of Moses gets told there at the beginning of the book. And it comes back around to the Israelites in chapter 2 and in verse 23. And it says, "During those many days the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery, and they cried out for help." Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with them groaning in their slavery or crying out for help. That's very much to be expected. And if that's the only time they ever did anything like that, you shrug your shoulders and you move on, right? And as you know very well, this is about almost the only time you find them complaining, right? Let's see how the story continues. Exodus chapter 5, beginning in verse 7. Moses had gone to Pharaoh and asked him to let the people go. And Pharaoh says, "You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as in the past, lest they let them go and gather them for themselves. But the number of bricks that they made in the past you shall impose upon them. You shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. That's why they cry, 'Let us go and offer sacrifices to our God.' Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it, and pay no regard to lying words." And then down in verses 20 and 21, the Israelite leaders met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them as they came out for Pharaoh. And they said to them, "The Lord look on you and judge, because you've made a stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us. So let us go so we can go worship God. You guys have too much time on your hands. Your life is about to get worse." And they say, "How dare you, Moses and Aaron? This awful thing that you've done to us." Now, if again, that just happened in a vacuum, you might say, okay, well, whatever. I can understand that sort of reaction, maybe. You're the guy that ruined it for all of us, right? Well, actually, in the chapter right before this, Moses and Aaron had met with them and told them what they were going to do. And had performed the miracles, the signs that God had given them. And in chapter 4 and verses 29 through 31, Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words the Lord had spoken to Moses, and he did the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord visited the people of Israel and had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshipped. And the next day, "How dare you, Moses and Aaron, you're awful people, look what you've done to us." That quick of a turn. Well, you know, the 10 plagues come and Pharaoh sends them away and the people just give their gold and money to the Israelites as they're leaving and they get to the banks of the Red Sea. And now all of a sudden it looks bad again, right? And Pharaoh drew near. In Exodus chapter 14 and verse 10, "The people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, 'Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians.' Don't you remember, Moses, all the times we just kept on chanting, 'Leave us alone so we can be slaves.' How can you have forgotten that, Moses? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And God parts the Red Sea, and they walk through, and they sing the song of Moses, and they celebrate God's victory. And then in Exodus chapter 15 and verse 22, Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea. They went to the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah because it was bitter. Therefore it was named Marah. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And then a little while later, in the next chapter, the whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for you've brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." There's no water, we're going to die. God makes water come out of a rock, you know. God turns an entire bitter spring into something sweet that they can drink. We don't have any food. We're all going to die. Well, God provides manna for them to eat. And again, in the next chapter, in chapter 17 and verse 1, all the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and they camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Of course, they get to Mount Sinai eventually, and the story kind of drops off there in Exodus, and you get more of the law. And so we pick it back up in Numbers in chapter 11, where now they've gotten tired of manna. You know, they've been eating this divinely provided miracle food, and that's a problem for them. You know, divinely provided miracle food. It can only take so much of that. Well, in Numbers chapter 11 and verse 4, the rabble that was among them had a strong craving, and the people of Israel also wept again and said, "Oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt that cost nothing. You know, nothing but our entire lives of slavery. It cost us nothing. The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at. I'm just tired of this. We need something different." And then finally, a few chapters later, at the entrance to Canaan, the spies had gone into the land, the spies had come out. And they offered a bad report, and the people had a problem. And in verse 30 of chapter 13, Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." Then the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are." So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim," the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. "And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." Then all the congregation raised a loud cry, and the people wept that night. And all the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And they said to one another, "Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt." And so here is, finally, the full rejection of God and His plan, God and His appointed leader. And you know what happens with the story after that, and that kind of takes us to what I wanted us to see for our purposes today, which is the difference between the perspective of the Israelites regarding what's happening to them in their lives, and the perspective of Paul regarding what's happening to him in his life. And the difference can't be more drastic, can it? You look at the Israelites, and what do they see? They see the chains. They see the taskmasters. They see the quota of bricks that they have to make. They see the straw that they have to gather. They see the Egyptians closing in on them. They see the sea that they cannot pass. They see the lack of water. They see the lack of food. They again see the lack of water. They see the food that they don't want to have anymore. They see giants in the land they can't possibly beat. The Israelites are so focused on their present circumstances that they could see neither God's past successes nor God's future promises. All the Israelites could ever see is what was right in front of their face at the moment. That's the bottom line. They saw an army behind them. They didn't see the God who had freed them from Egypt by plagues. They saw that they didn't have any food. They didn't see the fact that God can provide water from a rock. All they could see was what was right in front of them at that very moment. That's all they could ever see. They were what we might call spiritually nearsighted. the focus was always and entirely on the circumstances of that very moment and nothing else. Paul, on the other hand, was imprisoned. And what he saw was the gospel being preached. There were preachers preaching with the wrong motive, but what Paul saw was the gospel being preached. Paul might die, but what Paul saw was being with Jesus. Paul might live when he would rather go be with Jesus, but what he saw was an opportunity to continue to preach to the Philippians and others as well. You see, Paul was so focused on God that he never seemed to see his immediate circumstances. That's the difference. The Israelites were spiritually nearsighted, and Paul was spiritually farsighted. The question is, what was he focusing on, and what were they focusing on? All they could ever see were their immediate circumstances, which was the very thing he continually looked past. He elaborates on this basic idea in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Where Paul says here, "So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." This is Paul's perspective. It's a perspective that says it doesn't matter what's happening here and now, because the here and now will end. What matters is what's happening in the realm of eternity, because that is the only thing that lasts. William Ralph Ingalls said, "It's quite natural and inevitable that if we spend 16 hours daily of our waking lives thinking about the affairs of the world, and 5 minutes in thinking about God and our souls, the world will seem 200 times more real to us than God." I think that's absolutely right. What do we fill our minds, what do we fill our lives with? If it's with the physical, the world seems most real. If it's with the spiritual, the unseen seems most real. How do we become fearless like Peter was at Pentecost? How do we become fearless like Stephen was in the face of his adversaries? How do we become fearless like Paul was over and over and over and over and over again? We look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. We change our focus, we change our perspective to understand that what's really real are the things that we can't see, the things of God. And even as we share together in the Lord's Supper today, there is an element of that here. Because here we are, sharing in some food that we say represents the body and blood of Jesus. A person we've never met and have never seen. And we say is here with us today. What it looks like is we're each getting a little bit of food. And we're done with it, and then we carry on with our lives. That's what the Israelites would see today. But Paul would see something far, far greater as we share in this meal. And this week by week becomes an opportunity for us to practice this thing that Paul talks about shaping our spiritual vision so that we look not to the here and now, but look continually to the eternal.
You'll turn with me to page number 339. 339.